Accession number 13247, reel 1.
Gilbert Green, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
In Dulwich, London.
Which year was that?
1918.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a buyer in Iron Arm Morley's, the underwear people in Cheapside, London.
Did you go to school in Dulwich?
I did.
And how old were you when you finished your schooling?
17.
Did you get a job?
No, I went to drama school.
When was this? Which year was this?
37, 38 time.
So how did you come to be in the army?
I joined the TA during the Munich crisis.
Why did you decide to do that?
Well, we had a meeting of several friends who we were all at school together, and we kept in touch because we had our own dance band in those days. And we decided then what we were going to do, and myself and two friends who were brothers decided to go to our local TA regiment, because at Dulwich we had a very big OTC and they were our parent regiment, if you like. We were affiliated, the OTC at Dulwich was affiliated to this TA regiment, which was the old 1st Surrey Rifles, was then 35th Searchlight Regiment at barracks in Dulwich, or Flodden Road were the headquarters at Campbell. And the barracks we went to were the Dulwich side of the regiment, in the Highwood Barracks in Lordship Lane, Dulwich.
And this was Royal Engineers?
That's right, 35th Searchlight Regiment, Royal Engineers.
What kind of things did you learn to do once you joined?
All the normals of driving. It's when I first started driving, it was in 1938, and the various requirements for running a searchlight site. Generating the electricity and working the light. Basically, that was about it.
How did you generate the electricity?
In those days, we used to have a vehicle that very few people seem to know about, a Tilling Stevens petrol-electric, a 3-ton vehicle, which the searchlights on Caterpillar tracks could be hauled up into. And it had its own generator. The petrol engine drove the generator, which also supplied the electricity for the light, and also ran the vehicle. So that, in fact, it was electrically run, virtually.
And how were the searchlights operated in those days?
The technicalities of it were, in fact, of course, electricity generated by the lorry, draw a cable into the light itself, which was then a two-pronged arc light, 90 millimetre they were. The 150 followed later when it was found that the 90 millimetre wasn't really strong enough. It was a searchlight used in the 1418 war, but the fact that aircraft were flying much higher than was expected, the beam wasn't all that powerful enough, and during the first years of the war, the 150 centimetre light, a much bigger light obviously, was produced, and even then it was still unsatisfactory to aircraft flying at 20,000 feet plus. So the searchlights were arranged in groups of three, one 150 master beam and two satellite 90 centimetre searchlights in the form of a triangle on the ground, which gave a much stronger and longer beam.
How close to the AA batteries were the searchlights supposed to be?
Well, they were, in fact, in different areas. There were areas allocated to searchlights and also areas allocated to guns. So, in fact, it was very seldom that you got a gun and a searchlight within any close proximity.
So this also. You mean you could be miles away?
Well, not miles, perhaps a mile, yes. But also, of course, the searchlights also had to lock in, as it were, in an overall pattern with the guns and also with RAF Fighter Command, because obviously the aircraft couldn't fly around in a gun area, otherwise we should be shooting our own planes down. But it was all mapped out into a pattern on a map on the ground, so that each complemented the other without interfering with each other, as it were.
How did you communicate with each other, the battery and the searchlight?
Well, there was no real contact apart from troop headquarters. First of all, it was by Donar. But we did have a very simple form of a radio network, which wasn't very satisfactory. The sets were very unreliable, and therefore, mostly, at any time of day, and particularly at dusk until dawn, we had our own spotters in each detachment, in spotting chairs, which they lay back in. It was like a fanciful deck chair, really, but it rotated, and the spotters were there with binoculars, just scanning the skies. If aircraft were heard, they were identified first of all as ours or enemy, and they were the ones who guided the beam onto the aircraft, or in daylight by sight. There were two spotters with each detachment, probably 50 yards from the light, the searchlight.
So it was just a question of the searchlights doing their best to focus on enemy planes, and then
they relied on the battery to
do their stuff.
Yes, yeah. The number four, I think, was the one on the wheel of the searchlight, a long arm. Came from the searchlight with a steering wheel on the end, and obviously pushing the arm or pulling back rotated the searchlight, and the wheel altered the angle of the beam, turned it up or down. And the spotters, as soon as they heard something, of course they started looking, or anyone in the detachment that heard anything would bring the spotters' attention to it if they hadn't heard it already, and then they identified the aircraft, and then by left, 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 or up, 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 or down, 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 or so on, indications to the number four on the searchlight where to direct it. And when the light was on the target, so the beam would be struck. It wouldn't necessarily be struck right away, so it was searching. The beam wouldn't be searching. The detachment would search, and then when it was on target, they would strike the beam.
What do you mean by strike the beam?
Well, turn it on. There was, of course, a sound locator as well, a fairly primitive one to start with, which was just operated by hand, with four box cones, with two listeners who had earphones, and when the sound locator picked up the aircraft by sound, they would focus the sound locator on, with the one in control of the sound locator, watching through a target. And when this sound indicator was on, so he would give directions to the light, apart from the spotters. After 2 or 3 years, a couple of years, I suppose, there were very big towed sound indicators with microphones, electric, or radio control, if you like, with great big parabolas, steel parabolas, great big dishes with a microphone in each one on a four-wheel trailer. This is when I came into it a bit then, because I was then a bombardier and I was responsible for the sound locator and training the listeners. But we were all on seats on a revolving platform with these microphones so that we could again listen far with much better efficiency, obviously, to the sound of the aircraft. And when we were on, this sound locator now was connected to the light so that I could control the light from the sound locator. And when the sound locator was on target, by bringing two pointed levers together, that searchlight would move exactly the same way that the sound locator was moving. And when they was dead on, spot on like that, I will call through a radio connection to the number four on the light to expose, and the theory being that if those two pointers were together, then the beam would be directly on the target when it came on, which it was mostly.
What kind of rank of person was in charge of a searchlight crew?
Usually bombardier.
And how big a size of crew would he have under him?
Eight, normally in a detachment.
What did you think of the training that you got in the TA before war started?
Well, it was quite good, really. We were quite happy to do the job and did it quite successfully. Once we got used to the routines of being called up and organised. At first it was a little bit shaky, of course, particularly, as I say, we joined a year before the war actually was started. And we were mobilised for 1 month down in Sussex. And I suppose by modern terms, it was a wee bit of a shambles. Everybody was so very unprepared. We joined at Highwood Barracks, as I said, in London, and everybody was in a dash to get organised and get something done. These friends, we decided, the three of us, to join the First Surreys, and two more friends decided they were going for the RAF, and another one, I remember, was decided on the Navy, so that we sort of split apart, although we all decided to do something about it. We were the only three that actually joined the Surreys, First Surreys, searchlights.
So this was in 39 when you were mobilised?
No, this is 38 when we first joined. For this month, we were mobilised for 1 month. But with no equipment, no uniforms really. I remember these two friends of mine, one had his school blazer and a pair of khaki trousers, and the other one had a khaki tunic and his own grey flannels, and this sort of thing, you know. We went down into Sussex, actually, near East Rinsid, Nutley. I remember now the convoy started out from Dunwich. We had six London buses, two Thomas Cook furniture vans for the stores, and the ration wagon. I always thought it was very suitable. It was a Cadbury's chocolate van. And that was our convoy. We stopped on the way down to Sussex at St Croydon, the old well, not old, at the original Croydon Airport. We all pulled up suddenly. No one could understand why. And then we saw that I was in one bus on top deck at the front. We stopped and there was a bit of a hoo-ha going on in the bus in front of us, and one chappie was carried down from the top, laid out on the grass verge, while he had an epileptic fit. And then, having got over that, he was put back on the bus, and we all moved off again. That was going to war. Well, the war wasn't started, so there. Anyway, we went down to Nutley, very small village, about 5 miles south of East Grinstead. My home was then at Eastbourne, so I was quite near home. But we went into the grounds of a very large pub hotel in Nutley, about the biggest one there, I suppose. And I and my two friends were lodged or billeted in a little single building all by itself, no bigger than a garage, with a stone carving over the door with mental asylum on it. Everybody else said we'd been put in the right place because we were quite characterised, actually. But we spent the first 10 days or 2 weeks there, poured with rain, I can remember, all the time, and we dug a hole 20 feet square and 12 feet deep. That was our job. And that was to be a petrol dump. And then the petrol was delivered in 4 gallon cans. And as we put the last can in, I don't know how many cans, but quite a few to fill a hole that size, of course. As we put the last can in, it was decided to move it all together. So we then took them all out again and filled the hole in and moved off. So that was our first attempt at warlike manoeuvres.
What were you doing when war was declared?
I was... Well, as I say, I was at drama school, not a school, and I'd in the theatre by then. And in actual fact, in August 1939, I was on tour with a play, French Without Tears, having been several places around the country. And we were in Wales at the time, South Wales. And a telegram was readdressed to me there just before Wednesday matinee started, saying I had to report to my unit immediately. So someone else had to take over for me. I was stage directing and playing a part in that, and I immediately came home and went up to Highwood Barracks to report, and that was early August of 39, about 3 weeks before war was actually declared in September.
What happened once you got there?
Well, we were properly kitted out then, of course, with everything that we needed, and we went, first of all, to Staines. We were on a field just off Staines Bridge, on the Egham Road, I think it was, on the Egham Road, about 200 or 300 yards from Staines Bridge. That's part of the inner circle of lights. Apart from the lights actually in London itself, we were the sort of next circle out. And we had two bell tents, and the light and the sound locator, of course, with the generator lorry tucked under a tree in the corner of the field. The two bell tents, I remember, I don't think had been unwrapped since they were folded up in 1918, because they split, and there were about, well, as I say, 8 or 9 in the detachment, so we were split between these two five in each, or we had some stores in one, so I think we had six in one tent, three in the other with the stores and that sort of thing. But we had to arrange our gum boots around inside the tent to catch the drips from various holes in the tent where the rain came in.
So the unit was being deployed at Staines?
Well, yes, we were one detachment. We were actually at Staines.
And earlier at Nutley, the unit had been deployed at Nutley for the Munich crisis, had it?
Yes, that's right, yeah. I can't remember where the battery headquarters or troop headquarters were at Nutley. I can only remember where we were ourselves, because we weren't really in detachments then. We were in groups of, navvies, I suppose. You know, we were working, as I say, building, digging these petrol dumps and that various things like that. But when we, in 39, when the balloon had gone up, we were, of course, in proper detachments with equipment. As I say, we were at Stange. I think the troop headquarters was at Raysbury. I think it was Raysbury. We moved around so much. We were in this field. We had the two tents. A few weeks later, a hut was delivered, which stayed. We weren't allowed to erect it, although it was very simple. Various sections just bolted together. The piles had to go down for the flooring, and then the thing built on that. But we weren't allowed to touch it. The contractors had to come and do it themselves. So it laid out on the field, flat on the field, all through a terrible wet 5 or 6 weeks. By the time they came to put it together, it was all slightly warped, so it didn't ever quite join up when we did get it. And it was called sodden. We had one of these standard stoves with a chimney up through the roof, which we had to light for several days, if not a week, to dry the whole thing out, because it was started steaming, you know, with the heat from the stove. Our air defence against all the German bombers and the German paratroops that we were promised would be arriving any moment. Our defence was a Lewis gun, which was a favourite light machine gun from the 1418 war, with a round magazine on the front, which jammed after about every 5 or 6 rounds. You know, whack it with the ball of the thumb, which was just on a post in the middle of this field. And that was our air defence. And strange how psychological things, see, we thought, well, we must have some sort of protection if we're expecting all these terrible things, of pictures of German paratroopers with miter machine guns and dripping with grenades and every other possible automatic weapon. We got this one Lewis gun between 8 of us. We had 1 or 2 rifles as well, certainly. So we thought, well, we ought to have some sort of protection. Make this into a gun pit rather than just a gun on a stick in the middle of the field. So it's all very crazy, of course, now. So we cut a load of hedge and shrubbery from the round surround of the field and built a gun pit out of branches and greenery. And, you know, even so, when we got inside that on the gun at any time, we felt that we had some sort of slight protection. But
how long were you there for?
Let's see, we were there until just before Christmas, and then we moved on to another area, another site.
Down where? Yeah.
Another area. We went to, where are we? Oh yes, up to Nettlebed, on the Henley Oxford Road. Battery headquarters were at Nettlebed in the Working Men's Club. Strange place in those days, Nettlebed. Only about half a dozen houses, two pubs, and an enormous Working Men's Club, which was our became our battery headquarters.
But this is the same unit, is it?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Searchlight,
yes, we were on the move every few months. When we were there, I was brought into, I can't remember exactly why, into a battery headquarters for a while. I think they were short of an NCO or something, I was bombardier. And I remember very clearly one strange happening. I was given the job of going to London with two chaps as escort to pick up a chappy who'd overstayed his leave, and he'd been picked up in London by one of the Guards regiments, I can't remember which one, either the Coldstreams, I think, and was in the guard room at Chelsea Barracks. Now, we used to go up regularly at that time to London. We're talking about 1940 now. The raids had just started, and all the damaged material of buildings that were had been bombed was all assembled in Hyde Park in various dumps, all stonework, bricks, and wood, etc., etc. And we used an enormous amount of wood for all these stoves we had on these sites. And I was sent up with one of our lorries to get a huge stack of wood to bring back to be passed out to the various sites. And I also had to take sidearms and rifles with these two chaps and collect this prisoner from Chelsea Barracks. So we went to Hyde Park first. We left at about 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. It was dark in this petrol-electric lorry. And we discovered it had a leak in its radiator halfway. And the very old-fashioned type of lorry, of course, no proper cab, just a canvas hood over the top, strapped down to the windscreen, and a wooden floor. And through the wooden floor, we could see the exhaust manifold getting red and then white hot, where the radiator was lacking water and leaking. So we managed to knock somebody up and get some water and refilled it. And for some strange reason, I'm not quite sure why, we had some porridge on board. I think the driver knew or something that we might have problems. So we filled the radiator with this porridge, and it works as a quite good form of anti-leak material, because it bunged up the hole and radiator. We were all right. Anyway, we got to London and picked up this mess. Massive load of wood, and my two escort chappies were sitting on top, and we arrived at Chelsea Barracks to a guard sergeant on the gate, the guard commander, and I think he wondered what had happened when we drove in with this heap of wood on an old lorry to pick up this prisoner.